with our allies in the fight for affordable health care.
I'm Andy Seaton, KBOO News.
For KBOO in Portland, I'm Julie Sabatier.
KBOO's Afifa Ahmed Shafi reports.
I'm Stephanie Potter, KBOO News.
KBOO's Eduardo Villanderos Tiere has more.
I'm Annalisa Hummel.
And I'm Liam Delta.
This is Maddie Bowden.
I'm Alex Collins, KBOO News.
I'm Michael Newman, KBOO News.
I'm Courtney Dillard, KBOO News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, corrections workers in Hillsborough are thinking about a strike.
Arsonists started fires in several rural Alabama churches overnight.
Hundreds of people are feared dead in the Red Sea a day after the sinking of an aging ferry.
And in the human cost of occupation in Iraq, as of today, there have been 2,247 officially acknowledged deaths of U.S. soldiers, with as many as 48,000 others wounded. IraqBodyCount.org reports 31,900 civilians have been reported killed by military intervention in Iraq. Last year, the medical journal The Lancet reported as many as 194,000 civilian casualties, not counting Fallujah, since the invasion.
We're proud to be here with our allies.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, February 3rd, 2006. I'm Liam Delta.
And I'm Annalisa Hummel. Corrections workers in Hillsborough are contemplating a strike. KBOO's Isaac Kaplan-Wolner has the story.
Employees unionized with Oregon AFSCME, the American Federation of State and Municipal Employees, roughly 1 year ago. Public Affairs Director for the union, Don Loving, explains the decision.
In the case of Washington County, which is, you know, honestly and objectively fairly notoriously anti-union as far as the county government itself, it's the one big county in the metro area where most of the employees aren't in an association or union of some kind. And they were treating the community corrections people disparately from their other public safety folks. And so the community corrections people felt their best option to gain that respect was to join a union, and you know, they checked into a couple and ended up organizing with us.
In what ways were they being treated differently than other employees?
They're paid about 24% less than their fellow public safety people who do very similar jobs in Washington County. Community corrections deals with folks who are on parole and probation. There are other public safety folks within the county do very similar jobs on a kind of a point scale comparison, and also neighboring counties. And they just make way less money, had worse language as far as what they got to do is for promotions and benefits and stuff. And so that's what led them to seek a union.
The county corrections employees are currently in the process of negotiating their first contract. But so far, the process has proved unsatisfying to the union.
As we like to say, you know, the negotiation process is a form of compromise and give and take. And we feel that so far, we're the side that's been doing the compromising and doing the giving. So, you know, we need to see the county take some sort of step towards us.
Corrections employees have begun staging a series of informational picket lines to attempt to raise public awareness and pressure county officials to act.
Informational picketing is always sort of a process, if I can call it that. You do it once and people don't really notice, but the consistency is important. It's just a way to let the public know what's going on and that there is a problem. It's not insurmountable. You know, we're not quite to the threatening a strike standpoint, but we do need to let people know this is serious and it needs to be resolved.
According to Loving, the county has been punishing employees for their decision to unionize.
July 1st of last year, 2005, Washington County gave all of its employees a 3% wage increase in the form of a cost of living adjustment, except the members of our local. They finally gave that to them on January the 14th of this year, which is, you know, 6 months later. And it was pretty much just a punishment for the folks, you know, having the audacity in Washington County of you to join a union. And so, you know, we're very much fighting over that because we think that should be retroactive July 1st. Just so they treat all their employees fairly.
Union members are voting today to open the possibility of a strike in the event that the county makes no concessions.
The community corrections employees in Washington County are currently taking a strike authorization vote. Now, I want to emphasize this doesn't mean they're going to go on strike. Assuming that a majority votes to authorize the strike, and I can virtually guarantee that will happen in this case, they're essentially giving their executive committee the authorization to notify the county of a potential strike if they get to that point.
Loving emphasized that corrections employees are not yet planning a strike, but they would move in that direction if county officials are not willing to negotiate.
We would like to see the county commissioners kind of step up and do something about this. They've been very much uninvolved to this point. They've left it to the attorneys and the other county managers. The commissioners are the elected officials who are, you know, ultimately responsible for what happens in Washington County. And we are honestly hoping that the informational picking may kind of wake the commissioners up and get them to step forward and get involved and give the county negotiators some direction.
For now, Loving says the tactic of informational picketing will continue.
This upcoming Monday, they're going to picket at 4 o'clock, so a different shift can actually do the picketing. The morning folks have decided to kind of share the wealth there.
Washington County public affairs officials were unavailable for comment. I'm Isaac Kaplan-Wolner, KBOO News.
Cities in Central Oregon won't lend their support to a bill that would give the government power to log forests in the wake of a forest fire. Oregon Representative Greg Walden is sponsoring a bill set to be heard in Congress this month. KBOO's Kirk Beer reports.
The bill would give the government power to conduct salvage logging after a major fire, like the Biscuit Fire. Oregon Representative Greg Walden, sponsor of the bill, asked the Central Oregon Cities Organization to endorse the legislation as Congress gets set for hearings this month. But the organization voted unanimously against that endorsement. Bend City Councilor John Hummel says there's no reason to rush.
The science is still analyzing the impacts of post-fire logging. If you're wrong on those impacts, if you move forward now without understanding the impact, you could significantly increase the fire risk. So why not wait and make sure you get it right?
Hummel says it's too early to say whether the bill is good or bad.
At this point, it's not clear that the bill will help or hurt. Let's make sure the science can tell us that what's proposed in the bill will actually be good for the environment and good for safety before we move forward with it.
Walden says his proposal will help control future fires, but Hummel points to the Oregon State University study showing that post-fire logging can actually increase fire risk and set back natural regeneration. Content was provided by the Oregon News Service. I'm Kirk Vanderveer, KBOO News.
One person has filed to run for an open spot on the Willamette Education Service District Board in Salem. There will be 5 seats available. As part of an experimental legislative reform mandate, the district's entire board of directors will be replaced during the summer. The law removes the 9 elected board members and replaces them with 5 new ones. The 5 members then will appoint 4 more, representing business, social services, higher education, and community interests. Although current board members may run again in their new zones, none has filed to keep their job. The board has come under fire lately for its handling of a settlement agreement with a former employee accused of misconduct. They also elected a new board member through a secret ballot, which is illegal in Oregon.
The Coast Guard is urging all boaters and beachgoers along Oregon and Washington coasts to use extreme caution this evening through tomorrow morning. They say the strongest cold front of the year is moving through coastal waters. Seas are predicted to reach as high as 38 feet, onshore and offshore. The National Weather Service has issued storm and gale warnings for both coastal areas. They predict winds along the coast up to 40 miles per hour, with exposed areas seeing gusts up to 60 miles per hour. Mariners and beachgoers are encouraged to use extreme caution.
Changing climate patterns may be causing massive bird die-offs throughout the Pacific Northwest. KBOO's Noah Eaton reports.
The mass starvation deaths of mears on Tatoosh Island off the Olympic Peninsula may be due in part to unusual weather patterns along the west coast, scientists say. Last year passed without the winds and currents necessary to maintain the network of marine food crucial to the seabirds' diet. Breeding failures during the summer were preceded by tens of thousands of birds washing up dead on beaches in Washington, Oregon, and California. In Washington, the state's largest colony of Glaucus-winged gulls suffered when the normal fledge count plummeted from 8,000 chicks to 88 last year. The breeding failure isn't expected to harm the bird's overall population, but it has raised questions. Researchers met over the issue earlier this month in Seattle, but were unable to trace the source of the strange weather, except to consider global warming's effects in the past year. The oceanographers, atmospheric scientists, marine mammal experts, seabird biologists, and researchers who model ecosystems and ocean circulation now plan to write a series of scientific papers carefully documenting their observations. Last year, the region enjoyed sunny winter days with little snow in the mountains. The warm, dry weather also marked the third year of above-normal ocean temperatures. In early spring, the rain came, and when the birds should have been making and feeding babies, they were instead found dead. At the same time, researchers recorded low catches of juvenile salmon and rockfish, and there were sightings of emaciated gray whales. Those findings were preceded by the first appearance in Washington waters of thousands of squid normally not found north of San Francisco, and a plankton typically found near San Diego bloomed along northwest beaches. Scientists say to expect more of the same as the planet warms and weather patterns are altered. Based on monthly surveys, researchers estimate the dead birds numbered in the tens of thousands, mostly branch cormorants and common mears. I'm Noah Eaton, KBOO News.
Juan Nguyen and his wife Thu Nhi Nguyen of Happy Valley face multiple counts of tobacco smuggling. According to police, Nguyen and his company Sunrise Wholesale Inc. bought large quantities of untaxed tobacco from companies in Astoria, New York, and the Yakima Indian Reservation in Union Gap, Washington. Then investigators said Nguyen sold the tobacco to retailers in Oregon at a higher price. The affidavits indicate Nguyen pocketed the required state tobacco tax, estimated at a minimum of $500,000. The Oregon Department of Revenue estimates millions of dollars every year are lost to tobacco tax cheats. Oregon imposes a tax of $1.18 per pack of cigarettes. Oregon is the only state with a tobacco tax compliance task force.
Stay tuned for independent native news following our newscast. Then at 6 p.m. on Bread and Roses, join host Denise Kowalczyk for an update on pro-choice issues with Planned Parenthood. Also, a board member from Insight's Teen Parent Program talks about teen motherhood. At 7, it's The Essence of Soul with Shahid Hamid. Tonight's weather, rain with lows around 45 degrees and windy. Tomorrow, showers and a chance of thunderstorms. Windy with gusts from 50 to 60 miles per hour until noon. And on the coast, there is expected storms of 90 miles per hour. You are listening to the KBOO Evening News in Portland, Corvallis, Vancouver, and Hood River.
The State Department has ordered a Venezuelan diplomat out of the U.S. after Venezuela expelled a U.S. naval attaché for alleged espionage. State Department spokesman Sean McCormick says the chief of staff to Venezuela's ambassador is no longer welcome in the U.S. and has 72 hours to get out of the country. Yesterday, Venezuela's president ordered a naval attaché expelled for allegedly passing secret information from Venezuelan military officers to the Pentagon. McCormick says today's U.S. action is a direct response to that expulsion. He says the U.S. doesn't like getting into tit-for-tat games with Venezuela, but he says, quote, "They initiated this and we were forced to respond." The U.S. move also comes after comments yesterday from Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld, who compared Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez to Adolf Hitler.
The Pentagon's blueprint for the next 4 years calls for increasing the military's special forces by 15% and its psychological operations staffing by more than twice that to better meet demands in the war on terror. The plan is part of a $439.3 billion War Department budget for 2007, nearly 5% increase over this year, according to senior Pentagon officials and documents obtained Thursday by the Associated Press. Vice Admiral Evan Chanik of the Joint Staff says nothing in the document is revolutionary. Instead, he says, it's evolutionary, and its recommendations continue the changes made in the military to continue the war on terror. Undersecretary of Defense Ryan Henry calls today's document a long look and how the nation needs to defend itself during a long war. It moves the nation's armed forces further away from conventional warfare and closer to the goal of rapidly adaptable fighting units.
A New York federal judge says the EPA made deliberately misleading statements about air quality in the aftermath of the 9/11 attacks. FSRN's Rebecca Miles has more.
A class action lawsuit filed by New Yorkers against the Environmental Protection Agency and its former leadership can now proceed to court. Judge Deborah Batt said during her pre-trial opinion that statements made by former EPA head Christy Todd Whitman regarding the air quality in the vicinity of Ground Zero were deliberate and misleading, and that apparently false reassurances that the air was safe shocks the conscience. Internal documents later revealed that the EPA's own air quality tests indicated there was cause for concern. It's been estimated that about 2,000 tons of asbestos and over 400,000 tons of toxin-laden concrete were released in a massive dust cloud when the buildings came crashing down. Yesterday's ruling established that the accusations made in the class action suit are well documented and troubling enough to meet a legal standard to go forward, and to name Whitman as an individual defendant. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Rebecca Miles reporting from New York.
18 minutes after 5. Daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Who says television is a wasteland? If you're sick of getting 500 channels and still finding nothing to watch, get ready for the exciting debut of The Michael Eisner Show. The who? Eisner, the guy who was CEO of Disney Inc. for years. He stepped down last year and, well, now Mike needs something to keep him busy, so he's getting his own hour-long interview show on CNBC. He says he'll feature prominent guests from the worlds of business, politics, entertainment, and such. Quote, people I think are inventive, so to speak. Eisner definitely knows inventive. He managed to invent a myriad of ways to pay himself astronomical sums of money as honcho of Disney, even when he was ranked as one of America's worst-performing CEOs. In 1998, for example, Eisner took executive excess into the stratosphere when he pocketed $250,000 in pay. Not for the year, or for a month, or even for a day's worth of work. He got $280,000 an hour. Last year, even though he only worked 9 months, Mike sacked up a cool $1 million in salary, and then he added a nice $9.1 million bonus on top of that. Even better, however, is the retirement package he invented for himself. He'll draw $297,779 in pension every year for the rest of his life. Plus, over the next 3 years, he's to receive more than $22 million in bonus pay for doing, well, what exactly? Presumably for agreeing not to show up at the office and making a mess of things. This is Jim Hightower saying Eisner is the same guy who tried to take back the health care benefits of some low-paid workers at Disneyland and who used child labor sweatshops in Haiti and China to produce Disney merchandise. Maybe he'll have some of these workers on his TV show to highlight his own inventiveness. Today's commentary is made possible in part by the good folks at Mother Jones Magazine. Over the years, Mother Jones has won just about every award available while ticking off the honchos of business and government. They're proud of both distinctions. Find out more at motherjones.com.
An Alabama sheriff's official says arsonists started fires in rural Alabama churches overnight, quote, as fast as they could drive from one location to the next. Fires damaged 5 rural churches about 25 miles south of Birmingham. Most of them were Baptist churches, and all were near highways. Another Baptist church burned in a nearby county yesterday. A fire official says it had been under construction, which may explain the source of that fire. A 1996 series of fires targeted black churches, but these new fires hit both black and white church congregations.
A refinery official says crews are inspecting a fuel tanker that has been hauled off a beach in Alaska. The tanker was filling up at a refinery about 80 miles southwest of Anchorage when an ice floe hit it and sent it adrift. A spokesperson for refiner Tesoro Alaska says it took about 40 minutes for three tugboats to refloat the 575-foot Seabulk Pride. He says there's no sign the tanker leaked fuel while it was beached. The Coast Guard says 84 gallons of fuel spilled into Cook Inlet. However, the hull seems intact.
A group of activists critical of federal immigration package on its way to the Senate have begun a journey to Washington, D.C. They hope to meet with members of Congress to offer alternative ideas. The caravan began with a demonstration at the border fence in San Diego. The California Report's Amy Isaacson has the story.
Immigrants' rights activists dug a hole near the border fence and placed a white cross in the ground to commemorate migrant Guillermo Martinez. About a month ago, he crossed the border illegally a few hundred yards away and was shot to death by a Border Patrol agent. Caravan organizer Enrique Morones told the crowd Martinez's death was the last straw. He says they can't tolerate it anymore, and that's why they're going to Washington to tell the Senate to vote no on 4437, the immigration reform package the House passed last December. The Senate is set to take up the bill later this month. Morona says it's draconian and unrealistic.
We want to make sure that people know the reality of our community, that we're here to help the economy of this country, and that we're an asset. We're not somebody that takes away, but we're somebody that contributes.
But the bill's supporters say provisions like extending the border fence for 700 miles and enlisting the military and local authorities to enforce immigration laws will help secure the country and stem the tide of illegal immigrants. Meanwhile, marchers will place 4,000 crosses as they travel through 20 cities on their way to the nation's capital. For the California Report, I'm Amy Isaacson in San Diego.
Nearly 200 bodies have been found so far, along with more than 314 survivors following an overnight sinking of an Egyptian passenger ferry in the Red Sea. The ship's owner says there were about 1,400 people on board. Coast Guard rescue ships have been searching for survivors after the ferry went down in the first few hours of the day. An Egyptian presidential spokesperson says there weren't enough lifeboats on the ferry. Officials say nearly all the passengers were Egyptians, with one Canadian, 99 Saudis, 3 Syrians, and 2 from Sudan.
The Danish Prime Minister has summoned foreign ambassadors to discuss a growing dispute over a series of cartoons that have angered the Muslim world. The move comes amid threats from Palestinian factions to harm foreign nationals as revenge for the caricatures. The cartoons, which depicted the Prophet Muhammad, first appeared in a Danish newspaper in September and have since been published by several other European media. One of the cartoons pictures the Prophet wearing a headdress shaped like a bomb. Muslim groups are calling for an apology.
And that's the Cable Evening News for Friday, February 3rd, 2006. If you have any questions or comments about what you heard this evening, please call us at 503-231-8032 and leave a message on extension 203, or send an email to pmnews@kbu.org. You are listening to KBOO at 90.7 FM in Portland, in Corvallis at 100.7 FM on translator K264AA, and in Hood River at 91.9 FM on translator K220HR. You can log on to our website at kbu.fm. Our producer for tonight's newscast is Kirk Vanderveer. Our assistant producer and tonight's audio editor is Noah Eaton. Special thanks to reporters Noah Eaton, Isaac Kaplan-Wolner, and Kirk Vanderveer. Our engineer is Eduardo de Landeros Tierre. The Cable Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Lisa Loving. I'm Annalisa Hummel.
And I'm Liam Delta. Coming up Monday morning on KBOO at 7:30, Cecil and Celeste host More Talk Radio. Their guest is Alan Sager, co-director of the Health Reform Program at Boston University School of Public Health. The topic is the Medicare mess. At 9 on the Old Mole Variety Hour, we'll have an interview with Cynthia Gruggs Fleming about the life of SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee activist Ruby Doris Smith Robinson. Also an interview with Allison Weir, director of If Americans Knew, about the U.S. media bias in reporting on Israel-Palestine. and a review of the classic Vietnam War film, Hearts and Minds. At 10 on Health Watch, the guest is Dr. Mark Weisbluth, a pediatrician and sleep researcher. He'll talk about his book, Healthy Sleep Habits, Healthy Child. At 10:30, Monday on the Environment with Scott Forrester, and at 11, Democracy Now! That's all right here on KBOO, your nonprofit, volunteer-powered, and listener-owned community radio station. Rumi said, conventional opinion is the ruin of our souls.
Samba triste, das incertas madrugadas, samba triste, ecos de passos nas calçadas, samba triste, de São Paulo na neblina, na garoa muito fina, nas luzes amortecidas, samba tão triste.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Janine Jackson, here with Steve Rendell. This week on Counterspin, a White House propaganda campaign to sell its warrantless NSA domestic spying to the American people is in high gear. Some are taking the bait. Media discussions focusing on polls and the program's popularity abound, while discussions of its constitutionality are hard to find. David Cole, professor at Georgetown University Law School, will join us to talk about the NSA program. Also on the show, the New York Times ran a big piece on Haiti recently that looked like acknowledgement of U.S. political meddling in the country, where elections are scheduled for next week. But was the story less than meets the eye? We'll hear from author and journalist Anthony Fenton about what you aren't reading about democracy in Haiti. That's coming up, but first, as usual, we'll take a look back at some recent press.
There was one story the night of the State of the Union address that said more about the State of the Union than anything in Bush's speech. Anti-war activist Cindy Sheehan was in the public gallery of the address as a guest of Representative Lynn Woolsey. When Sheehan sat down and unzipped her jacket, a Capitol Hill police officer noticed that her T-shirt read, 2,245 dead, how many more? A reference to the number of U.S. fighters killed in Iraq, one of whom was Sheehan's son, Casey. Accounts differ at this point. Sheehan reports that the officer yelled, protester, and immediately began dragging her out of the gallery. The police's official version, which is the only version that the initial AP report on the incident contained, is that Sheehan was told to cover up her T-shirt and was taken away when she refused. Whichever is the case, Sheehan was arrested either for expressing a political opinion in a non-disruptive way or for failing to stop doing so. She was charged with unlawful conduct, though it's hard to see how that could be squared with the freedom of speech guarantee in the Bill of Rights. In addition to Sheehan, Beverly Young, the wife of a Republican member of Congress, was made to leave the gallery for wearing a pro-war T-shirt, though she wasn't arrested. The Capitol Hill police have since apologized. The mainstream press corps, however, are hardly sounding the alarms. Given their non-reaction to this and other stories, it's easy to forget that the First Amendment extends special protection to the press because the framers believed that an unfettered press would help to protect the other rights the Constitution guaranteed.
MSNBC's commentary after Sheehan's arrest provides a case in point. Chris Matthews was concerned, all right, but not about the frightening chill on freedom of expression. Matthews was worried that Sheehan's arrest was, quote, going to upstage the Democrats' response, that someone from the left is now being sort of the icon now of opposition to the president, close quote. Pete Williams, the NBC correspondent who served as the Pentagon's official spokesperson during the first Gulf War, concurred, quote, I think the Democrats tomorrow morning will end up all kind of agreeing, perhaps silently, that this was not a badly needed sideshow tonight, close quote. Matthews continued the theme in a question to NBC's Tim Russert.
Quote, is this going to be the problem for the Democrats who criticize the war in a more, perhaps, sophisticated manner to try to make a subtle point that's patriotic when there's someone out there who lost a son in the Afghanistan war and feels very passionately to the point of wearing a T-shirt into the House of Representatives? Close quote. Aside from the fact that Casey Sheehan died in Iraq, not Afghanistan, and aside from the weirdness of implying that wearing a T-shirt in Congress is some kind of extreme act, there's just something strange about a journalist contending that pointing out that government policy has resulted in more than 2,000 U.S. service members being killed is somehow not patriotic, or, for that matter, that subtlety is the most appropriate response.
Speaking of Chris Matthews, the Hardball host highlighted his own sloppy journalism on January 25th when critiquing a political ad by the group Americans United, which he claimed wrongly accused Tom DeLay of bribery. Quote, it's a political little bit of a fandango. Nobody's accused him yet of bribery, but that ad sure does, close quote. Guest Dana Milbank of the Washington Post seemed to agree, dismissing the ad as lacking credibility and prompting the other guest, the New York Times' Ann Kornblut, to remark, I mean, can anybody say Swift Boat? It's bemusing enough to hear a reporter suggest that the Swift Boat ads were so summarily dismissible, given the months of credulous attention that they got at the time. Indeed, asked herself about the ads by NBC's Andrea Mitchell over a year ago, Kornblut called Kerry's military record, quote, truly something that's subjective, close quote. But also, unlike the Swift Boat campaign, the Americans United ad in question is factually correct. In its critique of Republican ethics, the ad linked DeLay correctly with money laundering. The bribery charge was applied correctly to Jack Abramoff. Matthews had conveniently aired the ad at the introduction of the discussion. Evidently, he and his guests just neglected to watch it.
The radical Islamic party Hamas's victory in Palestinian legislative elections came as a shock to many. It was the New York Times' lead story on January 27th, running under the headline, Hamas Routs Ruling Faction, Casting Pall on Peace Process. Israel won't negotiate with radical group in government. That headline is misleading, however, because there is no peace process. It was stopped by Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon, who refused to negotiate with Palestinians. The New York Times surely knows this. Sharon's policy of unilateralism was reported by the paper. But they weren't alone. Many media outlets worried how the Hamas win might hurt the non-existent peace process. The effect of repeating this non sequitur over and over is to give the impression that the Palestinians are responsible for killing the peace process. You can call Hamas's victory a setback for progressive values, but any reasonable discussion of it should mention that the party that Hamas defeated, the Fatah party of the late Yasser Arafat, had nothing to show as far as negotiations, largely owing to Israeli intransigence. So it's possible that Hamas owes its victory, in part, to Israel's refusal to talk. If this is true, it wouldn't be the first time Israel helped Hamas. As UPI reported in 2002, Israel gave direct and indirect financial aid to Hamas over a period of years. According to a CIA official quoted by UPI, Israel's support for Hamas was, quote, a direct attempt to divide and dilute support for a strong secular PLO by using a competing religious alternative, close quote. Virtually no U.S. news media reported these angles, perhaps because it might have muddied up the narrative that holds that the Palestinians are simply acting irresponsibly again.
Finally, you wouldn't think Upton Sinclair and a couple of anarchists from the 1920s would be a hot news item in 2006. But for syndicated columnist and National Review editor Jonah Goldberg, apparently no news is too old if you can use it to smear the left. Back on December 24th, the Los Angeles Times published an article by reporter Gene Pascoe about a newly discovered 1929 letter from Upton Sinclair in which Sinclair discussed the trial of anarchists Sacco and Vanzetti. The men were tried and executed in 1927 for killing two men during a robbery in Massachusetts, and the left at the time, including Sinclair, protested the grossly unfair trial. Sinclair went on to write a novel, Boston, based on the case. Pascoe called Sinclair's letter a confession, in which he wrote that Sacco and Vanzetti's lawyer, Fred Moore, had told him the men were in fact guilty. The LA Times' Pascoe implied that Sinclair kept his doubts private so as to avoid angering his leftist supporters and readers. Well, at this point, Jonah Goldberg took up the story, using the Sinclair letter to claim that the left, as a whole, is corrupt and deceptive. In his January 5th National Review column, Goldberg wrote that Sinclair quite simply lied about Sacco and Vanzetti's innocence, quote, for the good of the movement, for his personal safety, and his professional success, close quote. His point was that once liberals, quote, reach icon status, the facts get inconvenient, close quote. Well, what about those facts? Reuters journalist Arthur Spiegelman looked at Sinclair's letter too, and he found that the LA Times report, clearly all that Goldberg read, had left out some rather critical information, like the fact that Sinclair wrote that Moore admitted that the anarchist had never admitted their guilt to him, and that they had in fact fired him after what Sinclair described as the bitterest of quarrels. What's more, as Greg Mitchell of Editor and Publisher pointed out in a January 30th column, Sinclair's novel, which focused on the unfairness of the trial itself, actually left the defendant's innocence in doubt, which garnered him a lot of criticism from the left. In other words, he did not try to cover up his own doubts or please his leftist readers. So Jonah Goldberg, basing a broad swipe of left on a factually flawed premise, there's some old news.
Thanks, Steve. You're listening to Counterspin. Counterspin is brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group Fair.
Perhaps fearing its policy of wiretapping American citizens without probable cause or judicial warrants might not bear legal scrutiny, the White House has launched a propaganda offensive to convince Americans that the policy is a good thing, and legal too. The latest push in the campaign finds the administration renaming the policy its Terrorist Surveillance Program. Now, who could oppose that? Many in the media seem to have taken the White House propaganda to heart, as discussions of the program's legality are few and far between, crowded out by discussions and polls about whether Americans like the program or not. Joining us now about all this is Georgetown University law professor David Cole. David Cole, welcome back to Counterspin.
Thanks for having me.
David, before we address the legal questions here, there seems to be some confusion about the program. What do you know about what the program is actually doing?
Well, we don't actually know a whole lot about what the program is actually doing, but it appears that they have authorized the National Security Agency to conduct electronic surveillance, wiretapping, without going to a court, targeted at Americans. How broadly, we don't know. There are reports that it has generated thousands of leads that have all turned out to be dead ends, and the FBI has been very frustrated with the kind of garbage in that they've received from the NSA, and that suggests that it's a very, very broad program, but we don't know because the administration has kept the details undercover.
Well, from what we do know, what's your legal opinion of the program's legality?
Well, I think, you know, in order to assess the legality, you don't actually need to know what the program consists of. You need to assess what the government has said about the legal justification for it. And the arguments they have made that it is justified really are quite astounding. The first argument is that Congress authorized them to engage in this kind of spying when it passed the authorization to use military force against Al-Qaeda. Now, that was about a one-paragraph authorization. It has not one word in it about warrantless wiretapping on Americans. And Congress, in a separate statute called the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, said that the president could engage in wiretapping for foreign intelligence purposes, but that he had to go to a court and get approval before doing so, that if he did it without going through this statutory means, it is a crime. And they specifically addressed the question of wartime, and they said during wartime, the president can conduct warrantless wiretapping, but only for the first 15 days of the conflict, and if he feels the need to go any further than that, he's to come to us and ask us to change the law, and we will consider it under those circumstances. The president here sidestepped that process and simply ignored and blatantly violated a criminal prohibition and did so in secret. And now they're saying that Congress, without saying so, and without, I dare say, any member of Congress even thinking that he or she was doing this, somehow gave them a blank check to spy on Americans in perpetuity when they authorized the use of military force against al-Qaeda.
Well, when they were asked why they didn't go to the Congress to try to get congressional permission, they had a curious answer to that, too.
Well, that's right. Alberto Gonzalez, in his first press conference on this, was asked that question. He said, well, we talked to some members of Congress, and they said it would be difficult, if not impossible, to get the law changed in the way we wanted to. So we didn't go, which is remarkable.
It seems that you think that the administration is breaking the law here. Is there a consensus view on this by constitutional experts?
I think there is. In fact, I signed on to a letter that was authored by 14 of the most prominent constitutional law scholars in the country and former government officials, including conservatives as well as liberals. One of the most prominent conservative scholars in the country, Richard Epstein at the University of Chicago Law School, Kurt Bradley, a former State Department lawyer under this president, President Bush, William Sessions, former director of the FBI, the dean of the Yale Law School, former dean of the University of Chicago Law School, the dean of the Stanford Law School, all agree that this argument does not pass muster. And that's the statutory argument. They make an even more extreme argument, which is that if they're wrong about the authorization to use military force, and if in fact the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act makes this a crime, the president takes the position that he has uncheckable authority as commander-in-chief to decide in secret to violate that law, and that it is unconstitutional for Congress to limit in any way the president's decision about how to engage the enemy. And that's a remarkable position, because that's a position that the president essentially says what the law is when it comes to his role as commander-in-chief. If that were right, then the statute that prohibits torture under all circumstances would be unconstitutional. The McCain Amendment, which the president just signed, would be unconstitutional. The Uniform Code of Military Justice, which are a set of rules that govern how the military should engage the enemy, would be unconstitutional. And yet, that's the position that this administration has taken. I think ultimately what this issue is about is checks and balances. Do we want to live in a country where the president gets to say what the law is in secret, behind closed doors, and violate criminal statutes at will? Or do we want to live in a country where if the president finds a problem with an existing statute, his recourse is the same recourse that we all have, which is to go ask Congress to change it?
Well, the legal issues here seem to raise flags, yet a lot of the media don't seem to be that concerned about the legal issues, preferring to dwell on whether the program's popular or not. Do you have any reflection on that?
Well, I think that's true. That really shows that the Bush PR campaign, and that's what it really is, has worked, at least up to date, in terms of framing the issue. And the way they want to frame the issue is, should we be spying on al-Qaeda? Mm-hmm. And I think the answer to that is, yes, we should be spying on al-Qaeda. But that misses the point. The Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act allows the president to spy on al-Qaeda. It allows him to do so without warrants as long as he's spying on al-Qaeda outside of the United States. And it allows him to spy on them in the United States if he shows a judge that the target of the surveillance is, in fact, associated with al-Qaeda. But if they don't have evidence that the target is associated with al-Qaeda and it's an American in the United States, that person should not be spied upon. And that's the authority that they're asserting, the authority to spy on Americans who are not associated with al-Qaeda without making the showing that's required under the law.
Well, polls on this issue seem to vary. When polling questions accurately describe what's being done, the numbers generally show slight majorities of Americans rejecting it. But in a way, the popularity is beside the point if the policy is unconstitutional or against the law. But by avoiding issues of legality and pounding on popularity in polling, journalists seem to be playing into the White House strategy. Do you think the polling numbers would shift if the constitutional issues were the focus of the media discussion?
Oh, absolutely. Because I think if you take 10 minutes to think about the arguments the government is making, they make no sense. Number one, they make no sense. And number two, the vision of executive power that they put forward is one that I think most Americans would feel very uncomfortable with. I mean, I think most Americans believe in a system of checks and balances, do not believe in a system in which the president can, behind closed doors, pick and choose which laws he's going to abide by and which laws he's going to violate. There's no reason to believe that if he asked for a reasonable and targeted authority to spy on al-Qaeda in ways that are currently prohibited by the law, and there aren't many, that Congress would give that to him. But he decided that for whatever reason, presumably because this program was so broad, it would be difficult, if not impossible, to get Congress to approve it. So he just went ahead and did it on his own. And that's not the way a democracy is supposed to operate.
We've been speaking with Georgetown University law professor David Cole. His article, NSA Spying Myths, can be read in the Current Nation magazine. David Cole, thanks again for joining us today on Counterspin.
Thanks for having me.
Most of the U.S. news about Haiti comes in fragments, like the one-paragraph wire service piece the New York Times ran recently, noting that Haiti's election authorities have decided not to put voting stations for the upcoming elections in the poor Port-au-Prince neighborhood of Cité Soleil. The item did not ask whether residents of Cité Soleil will be able to vote, but then it was only 123 words long. So many U.S. media consumers know little about the situation in Haiti, and experience suggests that that kind of informational void makes it easier for politicians to paint villains and heroes and generally spin things to their liking. We can expect at least some media attention during the upcoming election, but does Haiti coverage improve when there's more of it? Anthony Fenton is a journalist and co-author of the book Canada in Haiti, Waging War on the Poor Majority. He joins us now by telephone from Caracas, Venezuela. Welcome to Counterspin, Anthony Fenton.
Thank you, Jenny.
Well, we're unable to do justice to this story in this time, but let's jump in by looking at the media portrayal of Haiti as represented by a recent Sunday New York Times article, January 29th. This was a big, nearly 8,000-word piece, but its theme came through in the headline, which was "Mixed U.S. Signals Helped Tilt Haiti Toward Chaos." And early on, the piece put the matter as one of why the U.S. did not do more to build democracy in Haiti. I wonder what you make of that in general terms as a presentation of the state of affairs, that the U.S., by sending mixed signals, did not do all that it could to promote Haitian democracy.
Well, it's very interesting because in many respects the article by Bogdanich and Norberg was a very important one in that it finally verified in the mainstream media, if you will, the role that the U.S. played in subverting Haiti's young and flourishing at one point democracy there. That it was in the early stages of taking root, but also much to the chagrin of certain U.S. policymakers tending towards popular democracy. Now, unfortunately, the article, as you said, a very extensive article, and in fact was the most widely distributed New York Times article for that day. They have a register that says how many people emailed this article, and it was right at the top. But unfortunately, they didn't take into account the long history that these agencies that they refer to, the International Republican Institute, the U.S. Agency for International Development, and the National Endowment for Democracy. In fact, they're quite consistent when they refer to a program of democracy promotion. This is a program that's developed since the mid-80s under Ronald Reagan that, in fact, is diametrically opposed to any manifestation of popular democracy wherever it may manifest, be it Haiti, Venezuela, Ecuador, Bolivia, or anywhere throughout the world. So it was important in one sense, but it did try to present a benign picture of the Clinton administration as against the Bush administration, and it also tried to sort of scapegoat a specific individual working for one of these agencies, the International Republican Institute. And so I can imagine that readers would walk away and saying, wow, you know, that International Republican Institute, they really tried to screw over Haiti there. But one wouldn't walk away from it and say, wow, the United States, as I have and as my research over the past 2 years has uncovered, the United States policy in general, as it's applied to Haiti, but also, we must say, as I'm sitting in Caracas as we speak, as it was applied to Venezuela in the failed coup in 2002 there against President Chavez, that it is very purposefully directed against any manifestation of popular democracy. So the readers generally will not have walked away from this article, although, again, it's an important one. They will not have walked away from it with a thorough understanding of what U.S. quote-unquote democracy promotion is really all about.
The International Republican Institute in this article was presented almost like a rogue organization. I think at one point there's a comment that the IRI was going against official U.S. policy, that in fact they were opposed to the official U.S. position on Haiti.
Yeah, They quote at length Brian Dean Curran, a former U.S. ambassador to Haiti, who claims that, you know, he was actually, his intentions were more benevolent, and that, you know, and he was gearing, he would have geared policy toward genuine democracy promotion. But when you look at all of the other destabilizing factors that were thrown against the Haiti's democratically elected government, such as an economic embargo, such as the funding, not only through the International Republican Institute, but other agencies of an opposition group. They, in fact, helped build the opposition movement that helped overthrow Aristide. They also, the U.S. also helped train paramilitaries in the Dominican Republic that ended up entering Haiti from the Dominican in early February of 2004 that helped to create the conditions for the eventual invasion by U.S., Canada, France, and Chile on February 29, 2004, resulting in President Aristide's overthrow. So there was a much more of a collaborative effort undertaken in Haiti, and it emanates, of course, the U.S. Agency for International Development is, of course, linked to the State Department and the Pentagon, and the Bush administration themselves would have played a hand in this overall policy. So to suggest that it was only the International Republican Institute, that they're a rogue element within the U.S. Administration in general is quite misleading, in fact.
Well, this other group, the NED, the National Endowment for Democracy, it pushes right up against the question of media, and I know that you were directly involved in calling attention to the strange role played by an AP reporter that involves the NED. I wonder if you could briefly fill us in on that story.
Well, in fact, that came that information came out of a rare interview with an NED program officer responsible for Haiti. She told me that they're carrying out a sort of experiment in Haiti and that they've hired an in-country program officer. The NED doesn't generally do that. And that this person happened to be a Canadian journalist who is working for the AP, but not only AP, she actually was contributed to stories by the New York Times. Now, when I contacted, and Dennis Bernstein's out at Pacifica Radio Flashpoints there, contacted the Associated Press and the New York Times, the Associated Press then went to this journalist in Haiti, and her name's Regine Alexander, and she actually denied working for the NED. Of course, she didn't deny being a journalist, but when the AP went to her, she also denied it when they asked her, and they ended up publishing a story wherein they announced that they were severing relations with her as based on a conflict of interest between her reporting for them as a stringer, but also working for an organization that's linked to the NED. Now, the interesting thing with this, of course, is that the New York Times didn't sever ties with her. In fact, they said that it wasn't necessarily a conflict of interest, and nor did the NED themselves. They said it wasn't a conflict of interest to have a mainstream stringer working for them. They, in fact, said they wished they had more stringers working for them.
They might wish they had more stringers. What about the public, who one might think would at least want to know that the reporter that they're trusting for an independent analysis is in fact very much involved with a key player?
Well, exactly. In fact, this touches on other issues as well, because part of her work with the NED in Haiti is working with Haitian journalists. So she's training helping to train hundreds of Haitian journalists how to cover elections and how to conduct themselves in the context of elections basically under military occupation. And this is also tied into much broader strategy of USAID-led infiltration of Haitian media. The USAID has funneled several million dollars into Haiti to provide programming for dozens of Haitian grassroots radio outlets, an elite, that are using Haiti's media and Haiti's journalists to send this message to the Haitian people.
We're going to have to end right there. It's a fascinating story. Thank you for sharing it with us. We've been speaking with journalist Anthony Fenton. He is the co-author of Canada in Haiti, Waging War on the Poor Majority. Thank you very much for joining us today on Counterspin, Anthony Fenton.
Thank you very much.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by the staff and interns at the Media Watch Group FAIR, based in New York. If you missed part of today's show or you'd like to hear previous shows, you can find them on FAIR's website, www.fair.org. The show is engineered by Bill Seary at Mercer Media. With me is Steve Rendell. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.
This is Independent Native News for Friday, the 3rd of February, 2006. I'm Bonnie Sue Hitchcock. The Four Great Steps is what National Congress of American Indians President Joe Garcia outlined in the 4th Annual State of the Indian Nation as newly elected president of NCAI. He says the Four Great Steps refer to the spiritual outlook of the four directions.
Man must turn to each of these four directions to solve a problem. Today I borrow from that tradition to describe the task before the Indian nations.
Those tasks include public safety, health care, education and the economy, and the settlement of the Cobell lawsuit. Garcia specifically called upon Congress and the President to reauthorize the Indian Health Care Improvement Act during this legislative session, an act that has not been updated in over 30 years.
This legislation is the framework for the Indian health care system, and it fulfills the historic treaty obligation. It will bring our outdated and inadequate systems into the 21st century, addressing mental health, substance abuse, youth suicide, and support for attracting and retaining qualified health care professionals.
Garcia also called on Congress to appropriate more funds in order for tribes to implement the No Child Left Behind Act. He cited the success of the Alaska Rural Systemic Initiative, implemented in 1994, which connects children with elders and helps teach science and history in light of cultural heritage.
Over a 10-year period, student performance went up, test scores improved, dropout rates declined.
Garcia also noted the economic situation on reservations and says it is crucial for tribes to have access to telecommunications, e-commerce, distance learning, and electronic government to improve their status and economic well-being. He adds that sovereign governments are keenly aware of their role of providing for their people, and their success depends in part on the federal government's respect for tribal rights to self-determination and self-sufficiency. In other news, the 13th Annual Aboriginal Achievement Awards was held late last week in Vancouver, highlighting achievement, yet also providing inspiration for young Aboriginals. Craig McCulloch has details.
Tonight from Vancouver, the 2006 National Aboriginal Achievement Awards from the Queen Elizabeth Theatre.
The National Aboriginal Achievement Awards are held each year in a different city across Canada. Produced by the National Aboriginal Achievement Foundation and broadcast across the country, it awards a cross-section of Native, Inuit, and Métis individuals. Categories include youth, environment, heritage, and spirituality, law, and lifetime achievement. For the last 2 years, Roman Bittman has been the executive producer of the awards telecast. He says the major benefit of the awards is to set an example and give hope to young Aboriginal Canadians.
This big, high-profile show is to give a showcase for what we do, to provide the public doorway, window into the Aboriginal world for non-Aboriginals and Aboriginals alike, so we can celebrate our achievers, so we can give our young people inspiration.
One of those young people is Teresa Point of the Skokale First Nation just outside of Vancouver, half of the hip-hop duo Rapture Rising. She's one of the many Native performers seen by audiences across the country on the awards telecast. She says being involved in the telecast, although not receiving an award, is giving her group extra motivation.
Being involved in this show has given us a lot of opportunities to know our feeling what we're doing, you know, and seeing that there's a lot of other Aboriginal people out there who are striving for the same things that we are.
Formed in 1985, the Aboriginal Achievement Foundation, the organization behind the awards, gives away over $2 million Canadian in scholarships and grants annually. This makes it one of the largest scholarship organizations in Canada. It claims to be the largest supporter of Aboriginal education outside of the Canadian government in the country. I'm Craig McCulloch in Vancouver.
This is Independent Native News. I'm Bonnie Sue Hitchcock.
Supported by News from Independent Native News is a production of KUAC at the University of Alaska Fairbanks.